Thanks for listening to this podcast of Trending with Timmeri from the Relevant Radio app. Anything you share in terms of episodes, whether it's texting it to a friend, posting on social media, helps to build up the kingdom for God, to help confront the challenging issues we face as a culture, but with joy, with hope, and with an eternal perspective where our faith collides with everyday life, bringing eternal principles to help us live our life joyfully.
So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timmeri on Relevant Radio.
Do you find your kids or teenagers, or the kids and teenagers who you're around, seem somewhat disconnected? Discontented even, a little listless? Well, joining me in just a few moments will be Dr. Nicholas Carderis. He's the country's foremost technology addiction expert, Ivy League educated psychologist, and he taught neuropsychology at the doctoral level. He is the leading expert on what's happening with kids today. And we'll dive into ways to help teens find peace and joy and naturally reduce screen time. It's giving you a little bit of a hint of what's going on. We're going to take your questions as well. So if you have a question for Dr. Carderis, if you're trying to navigate how to do screens, no screens, some of the challenges with teenagers today, again, he's one of the front leading psychologists today working with teenagers and children. Our toll-free line, if you have a question, is 888-914-9149. And it's sponsored by Catholic Order Foresters Life Insurance. Also, coming up, did you hear about the deep fake AI-generated James Bond trailer? It received over 2.3 million views recently. And I think there's something to be said about the latest AI-generated content and the public's response. We're also taking your questions today. Again, that phone number is 888-914-9149. Joining me now is Dr. Nicholas Carderis. He is the author of two books I'm a huge fan of: Digital Madness, How Social Media is Driving Our Mental Health Crisis, and How to Restore Our Sanity. And a book I read about 7 or so years ago from Dr. Carderis called Glow Kids. Totally changed my mind, perspective, and really turned on a light bulb for things I think a lot of people had no idea about. That is how technology impacts kids. I think most people today recognize something's up, but don't really know what's happening. Now, Dr. Nicholas Carderis is the country's foremost technology addiction expert. He's doing work internationally. He's an Ivy League educated psychologist, and he's taught neuropsychology at the doctoral level. We're linking to all of his books, and today he's here to discuss ways to help teens find peace and joy and naturally reduce screen time. Dr. Carderis, thanks for coming back here on Trending.
All right. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here with you, Timmeri. Thank you.
There seems to be a massive disconnectedness, not just with kids who are perhaps coming to your program, such as Omega and others, needing true intervention, but across the board, a lot of teens today are disconnected, a little listless. And I'd love to hear from you ways that adults, from parents to caretakers, teachers, kin, and even family members, can help teens to overcome this disconnectedness. What's happening?
Yeah, so a lot of your viewers have probably heard about the loneliness epidemic that's going on with young people. And of course, we know that depression rates and TikTok and influencers, and we know that, you know, self-harm and suicide rates have skyrocketed. So I really think what's happening on a deeper fundamental level is a poverty of spirit. Young people are feeling, I think, an emptiness inside. We used to call it a hole in the soul. But there's a poverty of spirit. There's a poverty of purpose. And so they're filling all those empty, that void, they're filling it with digital content or other things. So rather than sometimes turning the telescope and looking at how toxic the digital world is, which of course it is, I talk about, can we strengthen our children's psychological and spiritual immune system so that they are more resilient or fortified or immunized against, you know, this whole digital world that we're all swimming in, that swallowed up the world in the last 10 years. And so, you know, there's, I talk about a couple of different things that we can help with our kids. And, you know, one of them is helping kids really find the true purpose or passion in their lives, something that really makes them feel, you know, Joseph Campbell talked about finding your bliss, you know, finding that special something that makes you get up in the morning and it makes you feel a sense of purpose. Because again, a lot of the teenagers and young people that I work with just will say, I don't feel any sense of purpose in my life. And the digital world can complicate and confuse that. So mm-hmm. if you can get a clear sense of that, that's helpful.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting, I'd love to just comment briefly, because from I'm a millennial, and from my generation down, I'll see over and over again, Dr. Carderis, where my peer set and those below me will say, I'm not good at anything. And they'll say it over and over monotonously. And I'm always startled by that, because I think it's just so sad that someone would just say over and over again, I'm not good at anything. Because it could be throwing a ball. It could be loading a dishwasher. I mean, mm-hmm. there are plenty of mundane things as well as grand gifts. And that's part of what this reminds me of when you're saying this.
And you're not going to be good at anything unless you try something. You know, so many of our young people, unfortunately, are, you know, let's face it, they're couch surfing. And, you know, because if you're staring at a screen, you're not really trying a hobby or a sport or playing a musical instrument, or like you said, even the mundane thing like loading a dishwasher. You know, you're not finding your inner whatever that is. And so to piggyback with that, because I think it speaks to what you just said about, you know, people who think that they're not good at anything, it's how do we help our young people build a sense of grit, resilience. You know, the psychologist Angela Duckworth wrote a book called Grit, and she talked about, you know, she did a whole study on West Point cadets, and she was able to identify this grit scale, and she defined grit as a combination of passion and persistence. So a lot of our young people don't have that trait of stick-to-itivism because, you know, they've grown up in that instant gratification world that so many of us have. That, you know, sticking to something, being able to lean in towards adversity, developing a sense of grit to pick yourself back up if you've experienced any kind of setback. That's also something that I've seen with the millennials and the Gen Zers that I work with is really hard to find. And so you only develop grit by practice, right? But you fall down, you get back up, and you encourage that, you support that. You don't helicopter that, because a lot of our kids, unfortunately, today are being raised by parents who do things for them, who are trying to immunize them by bubble wrapping them and making sure that they don't scrape their knee. But meanwhile, they're robbing their children of their opportunity to grow and to develop their own sense of autonomy and resilience. Mm-hmm. That's another one.
And I see it in today's culture. A lot of people talk about the dangers as if dangers have increased today versus before. And that's a whole debate in and of itself. There's much to be said to what's influencing that mindset. But I love what you say, that kids need to have, teenagers today, a sense of grit and resilience. Those are two things that I think many adults don't even have today. And if you're just joining me, that's Dr. Nicholas Carderis. He's a country's foremost technology addiction expert. We're linking to some of his books as well as his programs. And Dr. Carderis, I recently read an article of an interview of you with at Forbes magazine, diving into these things that kids need to find that sense of peace and joy. And you discuss grit, and you discuss resilience. You dive into helping them to use their minds to think. Can you share with me some of those tools that we can use as adults for those teenagers that we have a sphere of influence over today?
Yeah, so there's two things in terms of using their minds, because, you know, obviously we want we'd like all of our kids to be able to critically think, to be able to use their minds and use their God-given abilities to reason. Reason used to be the sword of reason, was, you know, part of the Enlightenment and in the ancient world. And yet so many young people today in the social media world, it's an emotions economy. And so they don't use critical thinking, but it's, how does that make you feel? And what's the emotional response? And what's the, you know, because that's where social media lives, right? It lives on getting that reptilian part of our brain activated. So I talk about, in order to develop that critical thinking, is, well, first of all, you can engage your kids by just starting off by just talking about current events. Like, did you read anything in news today that's interesting to you? And then having a discussion, but it's sort of a Socratic discussion about it. And when I say Socratic, I mean question and answer approach. Socrates was the smartest man in the ancient world because he admitted that he knew nothing, but he knew how to ask the right questions. And he knew to sort of probe. And so if you talk to your children about anything that they've seen, whether it's big picture issues like spirituality or God to some local political issue. Probe. So why do you believe that? And let's analyze that. And let's look at let's use a critical lens to discuss and to analyze what you're talking about. So we're not just using our emotions, but we were using our ability to do analytical and critical thinking. And what can help in that is reading the classics. It's great that sometimes kids today, you know, Harry Potter obsessed, or they'll read, my kids were obsessed with,
Hunger Games. Oh my God, there
was the other series of fantasy books that I'm forgetting the name right now. Granderson was the author, and I can't even remember the name of the books now. But and those books are great, but they're mythical fantasy books. But if we encourage kids to start reading the classics, it develops and attunes their minds in a way that is much more productive and can be. I mean, they're fascinating, and the classics can be, if once you develop an eye and an ear for them, they're entertaining, but it can also help you learn how to think and not just be entertained. And so if you read the classics and then you question your children about what they're hearing, what they're seeing, so you could have really a cool discussion with your kids rather than, and sometimes you might discover that, you know, there's a little bit of ideology being sprinkled in there. Teaching back at a university again, and I was shocked. I've got to admit it. It's just one of the state universities of New York, and you know, I'm teaching graduate courses in mental health, and I used to teach a course called Human Behavior. And Human Behavior 10 years ago when I taught it was everyone from Freud to Carl Jung to Piaget. And now this year, the textbook that I was given to teach from was the first chapter was critical race theory. The second chapter was Marxism. It was how to be an anti-racist. It was really ideologically brainwashing content that had changed so radically in the 10 years that I'd been out of the academic field that I had to start questioning my dean and saying, wow, this is different. This isn't human behavior that we're teaching. We're teaching something really different here. And so sometimes when you talk to your kids, you'll find out if their teachers are teaching them things that are ideologically driven versus, you know, educationally sound.
Yeah, and that's the scary part of education today is I think a lot of parents say, okay, we're paying for this good education, or we moved to this good school district so that you could have the education right. that you do. And then they're a little bombasted years later when they realize that wasn't what I expected, and it's a little too late. And I'm hearing this from people in all walks of life, from the public to the private to the Catholic, non-Catholic schools, that their kids are coming out with ideologies that they think they know things, but they're very emotive, as you're saying, that they have no critical thinking skills, and they're snowflakes, as my generation has been called, to trigger warnings, all of it. If you're just joining me, that's Dr. Nicholas Carderis here on Trending. He's the leading tech addiction expert in the nation. And I know we have a lot of questions coming in. We'll get to those in just a little bit. If you have a question, you can ask it on social media now. Just follow me at Timmerie, Timmerie, or give us a call, 888-914-9149. You can find my guest today, Dr. Nicholas Carderis, at drcarderis, spelled KARDARAS.com. We're posting a link to his website and books online as well. Now, I want to come back to something you mentioned earlier with regard to grit and resilience, because I feel like we could touch on that a little more. How do you encourage parents to, or just adults, to form this in their kids? You mentioned not just diving in every time they're hurt and not overly helicopter parenting, but what are some concrete things to help to build it up as well?
So, yeah, and thank you, by the way. And grit and resilience is the anti-snowflake. It's the antidote to snowflakedom, right, that you mentioned, because, my God, that's the epidemic right now. Anytime you develop, you have to be proficient at something, whether it's a sport or a musical instrument. That takes grit, right? You know, I have two teenage twin sons who are just turned 17, actually, and they both played musical instruments and sports since they were little. My one son's a catcher, the other son plays third base. The one plays the violin, the other plays the piano. Either one of those activities, whether it's sports or music, to get good at it takes perseverance. And it's not just something you can push. It's not like a video game where you can just, you know, stop and just come back to it and stop. It takes a certain amount of, it takes a mindset. And that mindset has to be developed relatively early on, because unfortunately, if you develop kind of a what's the, well, you know, they used to call it fragile and anti-fragile. If you have a fragility mindset and you give up when you develop adversity, mom and dad say, oh, it's okay. You don't really like that. You don't have to participate in that. You don't really like that. You don't have to do that. Now, I'm not saying to force our kids to do things that they don't want to do. You don't force a kid to play a sport that they don't want to play. But once they've chosen something, to encourage and nurture their continued participation and striving towards excellence in that, because, you know, somehow we've demonized merit and excellence, right? What's wrong with healthy competition, with being the best baseball player, the best violin player? What's wrong with excelling in your chosen passion? Again, not to the point where you have to be obsessively, you know, in a neurotic way, you know, kill your opposition. But we don't do that enough, you know, and it sounds so stereotypical, the 10th place participation trophies, but, but, you know, that has created the snowflake effect. And, yes. You know, unfortunately, teaching 24, 25 year old graduate students that I'm teaching now, I mean, I've had literally students break down crying in my class based on what another student said. And these are graduate students who are going to be mental health providers who couldn't handle somebody saying something from a different perspective, and they broke down crying in class. So when I, and that didn't used to happen 10 years ago. And so again, to me, it's, I'm attributing it to, you've grown up in this world where it's all about your feelings and your emotions, and you've lived in this echo chamber, and now you're hitting the real world, or at least and I wouldn't even say academia is the real world, but it's a taste of it. And totally can't handle life on life's terms because you didn't develop that grit and resilience and the ability to tolerate different points of view, because it doesn't have to challenge your whole sense of being and force you to crumble onto the floor into the fetal position, sucking your thumb because somebody said something you didn't like.
And I laugh, but we actually have instances of things such as these happening. You're mentioning being back in the education sphere again and teaching. And this is some of what you're saying with regard to developing that grit and resilience. I love where you point to developing those skills with instruments and the perseverance that's required. I remember a couple of stories when I was a kid. I grew up dancing. I danced with the Russian Ballet Company in Washington, D.C. when I was 13 years old. I was accepted into their dance program. And I remember times when I was much younger, I remember not wanting to go to class or just kind of feeling lazy and frustrated. And I'd find these excuses. And I remember my parents being very firm, specifically my mom, saying, you have to follow through. If you don't want to take classes next month, you've got to let me know. But we've paid for tuition for you for this month. Right. You're going to go to class. You're not going to be lazy. And if you don't go today, you're going to make up the class tomorrow. It was when you had the opportunity to make up the classes. Right. And she would say over and over again, follow through. And praise God, I have this great skill of dancing. I even got to teach professionally. And, you know, it's incredible to see that if I had not been in the thick of that, the politics that you endure, the disagreements, the lack of fairness or the perseverance that you're discussing, that was developed through that skill. But I have a question, because I think the challenge I'm seeing is these kids are playing, whether it's dance for me, baseball for another, an instrument for another. It's almost as if they go through their high school education. They think, well, this is what I'm going to do because this is what I'm good at. And then the world is crushed because they won't play violin professionally or they won't receive a scholarship. How do you navigate the balance between letting your life be overcome and consumed by that skill or that sport versus helping it be something to form the character?
That is such a great and complex question. And by the way, I loved your dancing story and your mom pushing you through that, because that's exactly what I'm talking about. It's exactly what I'm saying. Giving that nudge when the kid needs it, when they do that. What you bring up is really a great point, right? Because there's only so many Michael Jordan or LeBron Jameses of the world, right? So kid devotes, you know, 8 hours a day playing a sport, but they're not maybe going to be at that level that it's going to be their career. And the reality of it is, when I have worked with some elite athletes, you know, I did a thing with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, actually during training camp this season, I had the opportunity to work with some of their rookies on character development and their social media and some things like that. But I digress. The people who get to the top of their profession, they do it at the expense of everything else in their life. Think of the, you know, you were a dancer, so think of like the gold medal figure skaters, You know, and we've read the stories, the biographies of some of these Olympic athletes. They devote their entire youth and adolescence and young adulthood to their sport, 12, 14 hours a day of hard practice. And then let's say they do achieve the top of their profession, but then they flame out because, you know, then they've aged out by age 20 or 21. And now what? So life after sports, like, you know, one of my best friends was a really highly recruited college football player and couldn't handle life after, you know, the big stage. And, you know, I won't get into the details, but he didn't survive. He didn't survive his early midlife crisis at 25, because of exactly what you're saying. It's thing identity. To develop.
It becomes our identity in a certain respect, wouldn't you say?
Right. It's we shouldn't put all of our identity eggs in our skills basket, right? So, you know, we talk about when you create your sense of identity, who am I as a human being who happens to be a good figure skater or football player or dancer? But that shouldn't, all my happiness eggs shouldn't be in that basket, because once that's over, or if I break a leg or if I get an injury and I can't do that anymore, then now I'm crushed. Now I can't handle life because my whole identity has been defined by that. Now it's a great outlet for me to develop. Like you said, with your dancing, you learned to stick with something and to follow through. Follow through became the skill that now you can apply to everything. Following through in your radio career, following through in your personal life, following through in every aspect of your life. But your life didn't have to fall apart when you stopped dancing. And that's the tipping. There's a tipping point where you become so obsessively devoted to something that, yes, you may be the best in the world at it, but then when it's no longer maybe a part, you know, you can no longer do it, or it's not part of your day-to-day life anymore, you don't have any sense of identity anymore because your identity is so linked to that. Mm-hmm. That's the trap that we need to avoid. We should have a deeper spiritual identity where we're profoundly spiritually tethered and psychologically strong beings who happen to do all these amazing, cool things if we have varied and interesting lives, but that we don't overly identify with those things that we do.
And I love that you said that, because I can say personally, I went from dancing 40 plus hours a week in high school at 17 years old. I went to college and I thought I was going to dance to college. Economy tanked, everything happens. I find myself on a college campus with no car. Life is different than we expected. And I go from dancing in 40 plus hours a week to none. And it was a shock, but it was because I had faith. Because I was around people of substance of quality, because I had a strong family dynamic, that all of these things were in place, that even in the face of that challenging identity loss from dance, that wasn't the fullness of my identity. And that's what kids have today, whether there are different things going on at home, their identity becomes that skill. Yet at the same time, as we're discussing, I love what you're saying, Dr. Cardaris, we need those skills to train and teach those important things such as grit and resilience. Joining me today is Dr. Nicholas Cardaris here on Trending. He is not just here in the United States, but internationally, one of the leading technology addiction experts. He's Ivy League educated. He has written two fantastic books on the way technology is impacting children and teenagers. We'll be right back with Dr. Cardaris. If you have a question, our phone number is 888-914-9149. We're taking questions on the impact of technology use, navigating those challenging day-to-day moments with kids, and giving some concrete tips on how to naturally decrease screen time. We'll be right back with Dr. Nicholas Cardaris.
So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
You're trying to navigate how to use technologies, from screens to learning, you name it. Your kid's struggling. There seems to be this listlessness or disconnect and discontentedness among teenagers and children today. And joining me today is Dr. Nicholas Cardaris. He is on the front line And he's the country's foremost technology addiction expert. He's an Ivy League educated psychologist. He teaches neuropsychology at the doctoral level. And he has two fantastic books on kids and teenagers, helping to navigate exactly this topic. Glow Kids in Digital Madness, highly recommend them. Glow Kids in particular kind of rocked my world with introducing this topic of the impact of tech on children. It came out about 7-8 years ago now. We're posting links to those on social media and in the episode notes, especially if you have someone who disagrees with you. I have some close people in my life, and they always make fun of me of going, oh, Timmery's anti-phone. Timmery wants you to not use a toaster oven. And they start to make fun of me, and I start coming at them, boom, 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 with all of the data, just showing the impact that modern-day technology has, not just on children, but on adults. So if you're trying to navigate with your kids, maybe you have some questions, it's piquing your interest. The line today, if you'd like to talk to Dr. Nicholas Carderis, is 888-914-9149. Before we dive into some questions, Dr. Carderis, I had read a recent article where you were interviewed for Forbes magazine, and you discussed some natural ways to reduce teen screen time. Can you touch on a few of those?
Yeah, it was... Well, we kind of talked a little bit about it, but it was, I mentioned about talking with them about current events, but it was having open-hearted conversations with your kids to try to really explore what their values are. It's really sitting down with your child, with your young person, saying, you know, what are your favorite things that you like to watch, or what are the things that you love to do with your free time? And then from that, you begin to get a sense of what's important to them. What are their priorities? What are their value systems? Encouraging them to be creative, anything from crafts to writing to painting to dancing to anything that connects them to something other than looking inwards. You know, the phrase that we use sometimes when people are self-absorbed, it's navel gazing, but anything that gets a child outside of like overly obsessing with their own stuff. And so sometimes when you get creative, some people think that creativity connects us to spirit, and it's a way to get outside of our biological containers in a way that's can become obsessive. Nature, you know, getting our kids out into nature, the importance of that and how healing and expansive that could be when you put a child back into nature, because so many of our kids now are in their screen cages and mm-hmm. they don't even know that they're in cages, right? It's the frog that doesn't realize that there's an increasingly boiling water until the water boils. That's the way a lot of our kids and adults are, right? We're in this environment and we don't even know that there's a curve of the earth out there, that there's a horizon, that there's nature, that there are trees, that there's an ocean, because we're stuck not only indoors, but inside screens.
These are great ideas, everything from creativity, getting hands-on with skills from drawing to writing, getting out in nature, having those conversations about current events and your views. You walked through a little bit earlier how to do that to help see with the Socratic method what your child believes and how they can start using their brain to think about these topics. As my generation, millennial generation down, thinks they know things just because they took one class in high school or college, and yet they're so sensitive if you disagree with what they think they know on that particular topic. Joining me now is Dr. Nicholas Carderis. It's open line. If you'd like to ask a question, the number is 888-914-9149. I'd like to start with this one because I've seen this very frequently in my peer group. The question is from Gabby on Instagram. She said, I stopped giving my cell phone to my almost 3-year-old toddler when he ate, but now he won't eat well. What can I do? So I'll just dive in a couple thoughts. I'd love to hear yours as well, Dr. Carderis. I'll just share one thing that I know about 3-year-olds, because I have a 3-year-old as well, and we're in that phase where my kid's eating less, a lot less than she did before, because her slowing has grown around this time. And so kids around 3 years old really only need about 1,000 calories a day during that toddler phase, because their slowing isn't happening as quickly as it did before. And so I'm just thinking here that I recently went through this with my husband, that they're not going to eat 3 squared meals. And if kids drink things other than water, they're also going to consume quite a few of those 1,000 calories pretty quickly. So that's my quick initial response to it. But I'd like to hear yours about maybe some of the mindless eating that occurs when kids are looking at screens. Do you hear the question, Dr. Carderis?
I missed the first part of it. Do you mind just paraphrasing it real quick?
Yeah. So Gabby on Instagram wrote, and I've seen this a lot with my peer group. She said, I've stopped giving my cell phone to my almost 3-year-old toddler when he ate, but now he won't eat well. What can I do?
Yeah. So the toddler identified eating. It was with the phone that it was paired to the phone. It was almost like a Pavlov's pairing, like the bell and the phone were tied together. So now the child won't eat without the phone. Is that?
Yes, like he won't eat. And I'm seeing this with a lot of my peer set, that unless their kid's sitting in front of a screen watching something, and my friends will say it all the time, I'm sorry, try not to use tech, but she won't eat unless I give her this phone and she watches a show while she eats. That's the only way
she'll
eat. Yeah,
so, right. So like, you know, back in the olden days, right, they used to put a little, you know, it's almost like the mobile effect over a crib, right? If you distract the child, they won't realize that they're eating their broccoli or their peas or... Well, definitely it's a distraction, and it will definitely, on the short term, be effective because of that, because of distraction effect. But then the problem is you're creating a habit, and then it becomes now you can only eat with a screen, and then you could only do your anything else with the screen, and then the screen becomes dominant. And so it's a shortcut that I think we need to avoid and go through the tearing the Band-Aid off stage and just starting from scratch and saying, okay, no more linking the phone to food, because even though it might, my child may not eat as robustly for a couple of days, I need to kind of get back into having them just eat without the associating that with the mindless distraction of the phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'll just, I was weighing in too, because I have a 3-year-old right now. And I was just thinking that there's a difference. I know that they're terrorists. There's a difference between mindless eating and being aware that you're eating something. So like my kid will gladly eat snacks all day because it's somewhat mindless. You just keep popping it in over and over again. And with knowing that this age range is slowed growing and only eating 1,000 calories a day, she was not always going to eat a full meal. She's probably only going to have one real full meal and then kind of snack throughout the day. But we toe the line of, this is your meal. If you want something else, you know, you have to finish that piece of chicken first, and then you can have a snack. That's totally fine. She'll hold out for 4 and 5 hours sometimes because she's not actually hungry. If she really was hungry for whatever that other item was. So again, it's just kind of a different topic for that age range of challenges with eating.
That is what you're talking about too, is the opposite of what some people call mindful eating, right? I remember my wife and I, the Cushy Center teaches it's a macrobiotic diet, but one of the precepts of macrobiotic diet that was developed by this, my wife had a health issue and she had to eat very clean for a period of time when she went through this health issue. And in the macrobiotic diet, not only do they really focus on acidity and alkalinity for your food and food being very no processed foods, but you were supposed to chew every bite 30 to 50 times before you swallowed it. It was supposed to be really, really be present and mindful with every bite that you ate. So it was the opposite of mindless eating, was mindful eating. So rather than like, oh, I was watching a show and I just scarfed down, you know, 7 Big Macs. This is the opposite. It's chewing and really savoring every aspect of each bite. And then you find you eat less in a way, but you also feel more satiated. So maybe not good for your 3-year-old, but maybe good for the 30-year-old.
No, and I think that is, though, throw the screen in there. The kid has no clue they're eating. They're just chomping down while they sit there and eat. Right. Okay,
well, then you got the gamers, right? You've got the gamers who are energy drinking and junk food eating for 14 hours at a clip and, you know, ballooning out. So that's the other end of the problem.
Another question for Dr. Nicholas Carderis, and if you'd like to ask your question on social media or via phone, the phone number is 888-914-9149, or ask it now on my Instagram story at Timmerie, that's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. Madeline on Instagram asked, how do you cultivate leisure from a young age?
How do you cultivate leisure?
Yes.
Well, so one of the things we talk about a lot, that the best thing that a child can do is to be bored. Boredom is the handmaiden of creativity and really the most productive thing a child can do developmentally for their neurosynaptic and brain development is to do what's called creative play and use their imagination. Using their imagination creates neurosynaptic pathways of creativity. And so a bored kid has to do what we all used to do as kids. They have to play make-believe. And so playing make-believe when you're imagining things really is, you should see the brain under an MRI when somebody is imagining. The opposite of that is when your imagination is being pre-baked for you with a screen, because now all the visual imagery is being sort of drilled into your head and made for you rather than the child creating their own imagery. So, you know, when you're, you know, when the question was, how do you create leisure time? Let a kid be bored and they're going to create leisure activities. But for some reason, your generation, my generation, I'm probably a few days older than you, is we're so uncomfortable with our kids being bored that we feel we're constantly having to entertain them. Mm-hmm. And we don't realize that we're robbing them of the opportunity to be creative and imaginative and to develop their own leisure activities. Mm-hmm. So let your kid be bored. That's okay. And mm-hmm. yeah, there might be a little bit of fussing initially, or there might be a little bit of crying to get a device because they've been used to getting that. But once they get past that, you're going to see some pretty amazing things happen.
I have a brief story and then a follow-up question. The story is, a friend of mine has two children who have some developmental challenges. One of them is higher on the level of autism. And he, when he'd fixate and he'd have these fixating moments, she would have a really hard time just getting him to transition away from it. And, you know, being a mom with two kids who are having learning developmental challenges, she would just need a moment sometimes. So she started to use the iPad as a crutch. And so she was moving last year and she called me and she said, she looks at me and she says, "We're about to move. Convince me to go tech free." And I laugh, I go, "Why me?" And she'd been hearing you here on the show for the last couple of years. She said, "You've got to convince me." And I said, "Don't ask me to convince you that." And I said, "You're in different circumstances. I don't know how it plays out in those cases. But if you're going to go tech free, just do it." And she explains to me why she's using the tech as a crutch. So here's what happens, Dr. Carderis. She says, "We don't have screens and TVs like we do here at our new home. So they don't take any of the screens, the movies, anything. They travel cross country to their new place and they have no tech in the car." And this is her cold turkey approach. She said they made it through the car ride. They had a challenging first few days to a week in the new home. And now her kids suddenly get past the fixation when they were struggling to move past the obsessive moments when they were fixating on something, the child with severe autism. Now the children are interacting better. They're engaging in independent play. And they're finding self-coping skills that they had never had before because they always just had a screen to distract them from those challenging moments.
Yep. That's you know, Timur, you come up with the perfect life anecdotes from your dancing to this story. You're just there. You are so sharp and clear on this. Yep. Yeah, that's perfect.
Well, thank you. I do have a follow-up question, because here's what I'm seeing happening. I know parents are there and they're so frustrated and they feel judged. They feel uncomfortable. So I was at a family party a couple weeks ago, and this happens all the time. And kid anywhere between 5 and 12, let's say, will start getting bored and they start complaining, "I'm bored. I'm bored. I'm bored." Incessantly right. Telling their parent, "I'm bored." And it becomes volatile to the point where they're not just being disruptive and rude, but they start to get angry and misbehave. The parent eventually just gives in and gives them their phone or anything to get the child to just be quiet in the social setting. What right. can parents do? And I know this is a bigger problem, to start addressing letting that kid be bored in these situations.
Well, the problem is that the child has been acclimated to kind of being rewarded. We've conditioned the kid to, you know, it's like a Pavlov's dog, that they act out, they get the reward. So they're just doing what they were conditioned to do. I mean, so you do have to sort of break that, other than being the first time at a social event. That can't be the time that you decide all of a sudden, "I'm not going to reward this behavior that I've rewarded 1,000 other times to say, you know, to placate the child and keep them quiet." So, no, it's really beginning to just sort of break those bad habits at home and beginning to maybe have something, an alternative that can be the reward when somebody is acting out. But it's, I get it, because parents were tired, were frustrated. You know, the day is long sometimes, and sometimes you know that nothing will work as good as that. Giving your child that device, you know that it's the digital babysitter or the digital pacifier is so effective, but it's a Faustian deal. It's a deal with the devil, because then you're creating a monster, and it's going to be so hard to break the longer you do that. So I encourage to sort of not give into the shortcut.
And it starts at home, because if they're doing this in a public setting, it has to be happening at
home.
I did want to touch really quick on one last question. I know this is a big question, but Matt on Facebook asked, how long should be the max time an 8-year-old spends on a screen?
So this is a very individual thing. I do get asked that question a lot with terms of guidelines, 1 hour, 2 hour, 4 hours. It's really child by child. There are some children that can tolerate screen time better than others, and there's some others who perseverate and fixate much more intensely and quickly. So what might be appropriate, half an hour for one child, may not be appropriate for another child, 3 or 4 hours. It really goes back to what I call the psychological immune system. More robust, healthier, grounded, well-rounded children are able to tolerate a little bit more screen time, and kids who have been early on conditioned to the screen really can't. They can't even, you know, look at a screen without getting an emotional and a physiological reaction. So that the thing to look for is, at what point does your child get dysregulated when you take the screen away from them? So if it's in your child's case, after an hour you take away the screen device and you have a nuclear meltdown, then an hour is too much. You have to find that happy medium where your child's not going to have a nuclear meltdown, because, you know, this is their ouch point.
Mm-hmm. And I love where you mentioned it is case by case. And I think that that's key to understand. And I'll just say personally, my husband's tolerance in front of a screen is much longer than mine. I get moody, I get grumpy, and I'm an adult. It's just me interacting with the screen. And it is overwhelming and overstimulating for a child's eyes and brain that are still developing. Well, so many things to discuss. One of the big takeaways I received from today, among many, is how you mentioned we need to build the psychological and spiritual immune systems of our children, helping them to think, helping them to be bored and play with their imaginations and hands and engage God in their faith. It's not a part that we dove deep into today with Dr. Carderis, but he's a huge advocate for helping kids to discover their faith and to dive deep into it, to build that resilience that children so desperately need. You can find Dr. Nicholas Carderis at drcarderis.com. That's drcarderis.com. That's drcarderis.com. I'm posting a link on social media as well as in the episode notes for today's show at relevantradio.com/trending. Please catch his book, Glow Kids and Digital Madness. 10 out of 10 recommend. Dr. Nicholas Carderis, thank you for joining us here on Trending and for the work you're doing, especially for our next generation of children. I'll be right back to discuss the deepfakes generated with the new trailer for James Bond that is completely fake, that has generated over 2.3 million views in just a couple days.
We're talking about what you're thinking about. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Did you hear there's a new James Bond movie coming out? Maybe you did, maybe you watched the trailer, but perhaps you missed the prank. It's actually a deep fake AI generated James Bond trailer. Everything from who's starring in it to the content itself, all created utilizing artificial intelligence. The trailer in just a couple of days garnered over 2.3 million views. It features in the fake trailer about fake characters, well, characters who would be playing it. Henry Cavill was playing James Bond in the trailer, and they had Margot Robbie as one of the Bond girls this time. Now, these are not people rumored to actually be taking over the next roles in the next Bond film. In fact, Aaron Taylor-Johnson has been the latest actor rumored as a possible next Bond, but he's not been confirmed as such. But here's what's fascinating to me. This is an AI-generated deep fake James Bond trailer that for many people, they probably watched and thought, wow, This is the new James Bond movie. Now, if you watched the trailer, and we'll post a link to it on social media as well as in the episode notes for you to watch, it's pretty good. I think that it's not robust enough for specifically a James Bond level trailer, but it's both pretty good and scary at the same time. And I think that there are a couple sides to touch on. I think on the positive side, and I was discussing this with my husband earlier, on the positive side, there's incredible potential with the use of artificial intelligence, with AI, and all of the things that you can do to help quicken your day-to-day workflow, edit your document to doing simple tasks on the internet. Really neat. But one of the neat sides with it is it's showing the creativity that can also occur, that you can have mediocre skill sets and design and create something quite excellent and robust with artificial intelligence, even something beautiful. And beauty is a key part of the human person. Beauty, the attributes of the human person, attributes of God and beauty, it's so important. And as a culture, we don't ponder beauty enough. And so there's much to be said about creativity when it comes to the use of AI and its assistants. But the challenge is, and actually I want to come to the challenge in a moment, because there's something that was posted by the creators of this AI-generated, totally fake James Bond trailer that was done pretty well. The creator said its purpose is purely artistic, aiming to entertain and engage with the YouTube community. He said, "My goal is to showcase my creativity and storytelling skills through this trailer. Thank you for your support, and let's dive into the world of imagination." I thought the creator's comment was exactly what is the positive and pretty incredible side of this AI-generated James Bond trailer. He's trying to entertain and engage. He's showcasing his own creativity with the latest AI technology and using storytelling skills. That's pretty fascinating. And he's appealing to the world of imagination, his imagination of what if these were the people playing in the next James Bond film. Now, there's much to be said of concerns surrounding AI and everything from new tech boyfriends that girls are obsessed with as they have their AI boyfriends and chat robots that they talk to, or men as well. But there is a fascinating side of creativity that can be utilized. But on the negative side, the challenge is when we become reliant on the use of artificial intelligence. We become reliant to do some skills that are skills we absolutely need to maintain. And there also is that challenge and concern, if you're looking at the AI-generated trailer of James Bond, that people can use your own image to make content that you didn't feature in, that you didn't create. And I'll just mention it could be unsavory content as well. And so I think there's much to be said of making sure we have a strong level of capability, that we're able and talented at skills we need to engage in. Even if it's writing, using AI to improve what you write is great, but losing your writing skills is problematic. If you're not a great speller, great. It's wonderful to use AI to help improve your spelling and check. But are you working in ways that can also bolster and continue to grow those skills of spelling? And so much is to be said. As adults, people still need help with these tasks. It's that whole debate over the calculator. And when I was a kid, you weren't allowed to use a calculator. And then years later, you were allowed to use a calculator to check your own work long after you finished actually doing the work by hand on pen and paper. And today, I think most of the time, kids are allowed to use calculators quite often. The skills, I mean, I had to memorize my entire multiplication table, all of that. And so there are skills that we need that help build, as we're discussing with Dr. Nicholas Carderis earlier, resilience. And there are skills that can perhaps be aided or sometimes replaced with AI. But it's important to find that balance and to not use technology as a crutch, but to utilize it as a tool. Remembering the fundamental dimension of the value of the human person, of the value that we inherently have and the contribution we have to give to the world with our skills and also with our weaknesses as well, and how AI can indeed assist both of those. You're listening to Trending with Tim Murray here on Relevant Radio. And actually, one question I do have is, how many people actually believe that was the real James Bond trailer, and they're still expecting the next James Bond movie to be coming out any day? day now. You're listening to Trending with Tim Murray. A question came in from Natalia in Los Angeles, listening on 9:30 a.m. She said she was wondering if it's okay for Catholics to partake in Pilates. She said she knows that yoga is for sure out of the realm of practice for Catholics, but she was wondering about Pilates. Great question. Yes, I'm going to link to some episodes if perhaps the fact that practicing exercising yoga is against Catholic Church teaching. That's a different conversation for another day. But to answer your question specifically about Pilates, Pilates is nothing like yoga. So Pilates focuses on the spine and the structure of your body and helping your body to flow and move in a way that is properly aligned. So if you're doing a push-up, you're doing a push-up in the correct position. If you're doing a crunch, you're moving the spine in the correct position. And so while there might be some bodily positions that might be similar perhaps in yoga and Pilates, it's important to remember that yoga in terms of the physical movements really came from early athletics and gymnastics as well, and they're using a spiritual dimension that is the antithesis of our Catholic faith and that we can't exercise as Catholics. But Pilates is so good for your body, and I love to call it smart exercise. If you didn't know, I was a Pilates trainer for years before doing this daily radio program here on Trending. So it's a yes to Pilates and no to yoga. We'll post links if you want to learn more about yoga here on Trending. So be sure to check out the podcast, relevantradio.com/trending, or you can find us on the free Relevant Radio app.